Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 355 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 exams. Obviously, this podcast also applies to the Comlex Level 2 and 3 exams. As a reminder, if you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3 or Comlex Level 2 or 3 exams in December, so that's this month, or January, that's next month, you would want to sign up for the MBME Test Taking Strategies course that I have. It's going to be taking place next week, Monday, from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. That's going to be the same thing as 4 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll basically review many different approaches to MBME questions. Again, I've had tons of people take this course, this particular course, and a very good majority of the people that have attended it, their scores go up, their percentages on QBanks go up, and they end up doing pretty well on the exams. And then I have a 24-hour review course. It's going to be taking place from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So that's noon to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time from the 7th, that's next week Tuesday, to the 10th, that's next week Friday. Essentially, we'll go through PEDS, surgery, internal medicine, OB-GYN, psych, neuro, ethics, biostatistics, multi-system processes and disorders, professionalism, communications, and all those things. Again, I've had many people take this course, and they've done extremely, extremely well on the exams. So if you're interested in signing up, there's still spots. Just shoot me an email through the website. I'll give you some more information on payments and things like that, and then your spot will be reserved. Most people end up having about 130 pages of notes from the course. And again, they're about, you know, of the 24 hours, about 4 hours total, if you kind of add up everything, is devoted to taking and answering people's questions, right? So you're going to have your questions answered. We have many different types of questions, multiple choice, a lot of audience response and things like that. Again, many people have taken this course. They've done really well with it. So if you're interested, shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. So let's just jump right into it. Now, what if they give you a question about like a 62-year-old female? They tell you that, you know, over the last 2 days, she's been having this burning sensation around her left lower abdomen. And then you notice that, wow, this person has these vesicular lesions and they're on an erythematous base. And they tell you that, you know, this person has like very sharp pain as a result of these lesions. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, sounds like this person has shingles, right? This person has shingles, right? This person has infection with the herpes virus, right? So what are we going to do for these people? Well, I would really hope that you're saying, huh, Divine, let's go ahead and give this person acyclovir, right? Remember, acyclovir, how does it work? Again, let me say something here, I guess, right? For those of you that are taking the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 exams, don't think that pharmacology is just something that you've forgotten in the C of Step 1. No, these are things that you're still going to see on Step 2 CK Step 3, right? So don't forget, we're going to give acyclovir. And again, acyclovir essentially is going to be a false nucleotide and is going to inhibit DNA synthesis. That's a big thing you want to know with acyclovir, right? So basically, you're not going to be able to make DNA, right? So acyclovir works in that format, right? And what are some key high-yield things to know with acyclovir on your exams? Well, don't forget, acyclovir can cause renal failure, right? And it can also cause nephrolithiasis. That's a very big one to know. Right? So they can describe the same person, they're on therapy, their symptoms have gotten better, and then they start having flank pain relating to the groin. When you see stuff like that, you want to think about nephrolithiasis secondary to acyclovir, right? Remember, acyclovir is not the only drug that causes nephrolithiasis on MBMEs, right? If you take a loop diuretic, a loop diuretic can increase your risk of nephrolithiasis, right? You probably remember the mnemonic that, ooh, loops lose calcium. Well, they lose calcium, right? So they make you put more calcium in your urine. So because they make you put more calcium in your urine, right, they can increase your risk of precipitating calcium and can get a kidney stone as a result of that, right? Or if you think about the HIV drug indinavir, indinavir as a HIV drug can absolutely cause a nephrolithiasis. And then that's not all. Also the drug topiramate, right? So if they give you a question about a person that is on an anti-epileptic and they kind of feel slow mentally, right? They're pretty much telling you that it's topiramate that the person is taking. Topiramate has this predilection for causing a crystalline nephropathy, right? So those are all high yield things to keep in mind, right? So I know some of you may be like, oh wow, so Divine, loops, you know, they bring down blood pressure and they can cause nephrolithiasis. Is there some kind of antihypertensive that we could give that would help with not causing nephrolithiasis? Well, that's easy. That's going to be a thiazide diuretic, right? So thiazide diuretics, they actually make you suck up as much calcium as possible from your urine. So because they make you suck up as much calcium as possible from your urine, especially at the level of the distal convoluted tubule, right? So the DCT, the distal convoluted tubule, they can actually reduce your risk for nephrolithiasis, right? So again, those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is like a 39-year-old male and, you know, he has tried three different antihypertensives, you know, they've put him on an ACE inhibitor, hasn't done squat, they've put him on a calcium channel blocker like amlodipine, hasn't done squat, and then they tell you that they, you know, this person's hypertension is just not resolving. If you see this, what do you want to think about? Well, I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person probably has like Kahn syndrome, right? Whenever you see a person that has resistant hypertension on MBME exams, there are many things that can cause it. But one of the big ones I want you to consider is Kahn syndrome, especially when you notice that that person has hypokalemia and metabolic alkalosis at the same time. So how do we manage Kahn syndrome? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to check the plasma aldosterone to renin concentration, right? So the PAC to PRA ratio. Right. So, because again, in Kahn syndrome, you either have an adrenal adenoma or you have adrenal hyperplasia and you're making a ton of aldosterone. Now, that aldosterone will obviously raise your blood pressure, right? And when your blood pressure goes up, your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is going to be like, what? What is going on, right? So those GG cells will freak out and they'll make less renin, right? So your aldosterone is going to be shooting up, your renin is going to be shooting down. So your plasma aldosterone to renin ratio, your PAC, so PRA ratio will be high. It will be greater than 30 on MBME exams, right? So obviously, this is a good thing, right? Because if you notice that, wow, this person's PAC to PRA ratio is not high. So it's like less than 30, right? It's a small number. Then that will tell you that you are likely dealing with some kind of renal artery stenosis, right? Or fibromuscular dysplasia. Because in those circumstances, you have stenosis of the renal arteries, right? And because you have stenosis of the renal arteries, and I guess... Sorry, let me just say something. Okay, let me continue and then I'll say something, right? So because you have stenosis of the renal arteries, your afferent arterial is being hypoperfused. Since it's being hypoperfused, well, your GG cells are going to be like, okay, looks like we don't have much blood pressure going on here. So you're going to make a ton of renin, right? And as you make a ton of renin, right, that will convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 will be converted to angiotensin 2. And then angiotensin 2 will go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. It's going to make you make a ton of aldosterone. So your aldosterone and your renin are going up pretty much at the same rate. So your PAC to PRA ratio will be roughly normal, right? It's going to be less than 30. Many times it's going to be less than 20 on your exams. And those people will still have hypokalemia. They will still have a metabolic alkalosis. Because again, aldosterone has certain jobs in life. What are those jobs? Well, those jobs include making you urinate protons. So if you have a ton of aldosterone, you're going to urinate a lot of protons. So you're going to get a metabolic alkalosis. And also, it makes you urinate a lot of potassiums in your urine, especially at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. So you urinate out all those potassiums, you're going to have hypokalemia, right? So again, this is one of the reasons why. Because again, like many times, I think it's just very beneficial to not just memorize steps in management or diagnosis. Understand why one step comes before the other. The truth is, when you have understanding, you then have predictive ability. I used to tell people this, right, with organic chemistry. If you understand organic chemistry, the mechanisms, you can pretty much predict them. Because there are just certain arrows that will make sense and certain arrows where you'll be like, this thing doesn't make any sense at all. Right? Like many of these diagnostic algorithms that you see many people, they're like, oh, I'm going to memorize this table, this chart that this QBank has given to me. Ask yourself, as you're memorizing the chart, why is this chart this way? Why are they exploring this first? Like, why does it make any sense to explore this first step before the second step? When you have that understanding, then your memorization is significantly reduced. because it's almost like you can see right through whatever question is thrown your way. That is just the truth, right? But let me get off that soapbox and continue, right? So that's why whenever you see a person that has resistant hypertension with hypokalemia metabolic alkalosis, the first thing you should be doing for those people is to check the PAC to PRA ratio, the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. You do those things, then it will pretty much help you differentiate between Kahn syndrome, which is a hyperaldosterone state from a problem in the adrenal cortex, or fibromuscular dysplasia renal artery stenosis, which is going to be a hyperaldosterone state because you have a hyperrenin state, because you're hypoperfusing the afferent arterial. So your GG cells make a ton of renin. Now, that I'll come back to Kahn syndrome, but the small offshoot thing I wanted to talk about is the importance of understanding that renal artery stenosis and fibromuscular dysplasia do not have a similar pathophysiology. This is a common mistake that many medical students make, right? You're like, oh, you know, renal artery stenosis, fibromuscular dysplasia, all arises from atherosclerosis. That is not true. That's very important. That is not true. When the thing is, if you look at the layers of the wall of a blood vessel has an intima, that's the innermost layer, and then it has a media, that's the smooth muscle layer, and then it has an adventitia, right? Now, in renal artery stenosis, it's the intima that is affected. You have atherosclerosis of the intima of the blood vessel of the renal artery. That's why you have problems, right? In fibromuscular dysplasia, the intima is perfectly fine. It's the media that is messed up, right? So remember, in fibromuscular dysplasia, it is the muscle, the media that is messed up. There's nothing wrong with the intima, right? Even if the outcome of both disorders is the same, the pathophysiology behind both disorders is different, right? And again, obviously, fibromuscular dysplasia will be in a younger person, right? Renal artery stenosis will be in an older person, right? Although, believe it or not, our friends at the MBMEs, they're very good at also giving renal artery stenosis to kids, right? That's why many times when you see little children having hypertension, one of the first things you do is you're going to do like a renal Doppler ultrasound, right? Just to make sure that everything is good with the renal arteries, right? Because again, renal artery stenosis, don't get me wrong, is actually pretty common in kids, especially kids that have problems with other like urinary or reproductive structures, right? So if you have like a Mullerian abnormality or they have a ureteral abnormality, many times those kids can also have renal artery problems, right? So let's go back to Kahn syndrome, right? So we said for Kahn syndrome, the very first thing you're going to do is you're going to check the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. It's going to be more than 30 on the exam. Okay, if it's more than 30, you're like, sounds like this person's got Kahn syndrome. So the thing you're going to then do next is you're going to do something we call a salt suppression test, right? You're going to do a salt suppression test. Because the thing is, if I give you salt, right, your body's going to retain more water. It's going to raise your blood pressure. So your renin angiotensin aldosterone system will be like, this blood pressure is a little too high. Let's go ahead and dial down this renin, right? So you bring down your renin, you bring down your angiotensin 1 and 2, and bring down your aldosterone. But if a person has Kahn syndrome, they don't respond to those signals. You give those people an infusion of saline and their aldosterone will not suppress. So the thing you do is you measure the aldosterone before you give them the saline infusion. And then you measure the aldosterone after you've given them the saline infusion. You'll notice that the aldosterone fails to suppress, right, with saline infusion. That's the thing that will tell you, okay, this person's got Kahn syndrome. Actually, the salt suppression test is diagnostic for Kahn syndrome, right? The salt suppression test is diagnostic for Kahn syndrome, right? But again, you're not done yet, right? Because the thing is, sometimes people can have Kahn syndrome because both adrenal glands are messed up. Or they can have Kahn syndrome because only one adrenal gland is messed up. So how do you make those determinations? Well, the way you make those determinations is by doing this fancy schmancy test we call adrenal vein sampling, right? Right? Because if you think about it, if one of your adrenal glands is messed up, then you're making a ton of aldosterone from that adrenal cortex, that zona glomerulosa, right? That's going to raise your blood pressure. The other adrenal gland that is working just fine is going to be responding to normal signals. It's going to be like, wow, blood pressure is too high. So they're going to have low aldosterone coming from that normal adrenal. But you're having high aldosterone coming from the abnormal adrenal. So you have high aldosterone from one, low aldosterone from the other. So if you check the adrenal veins and you notice that aldosterone is high in one and low in the other, then you have Kahn syndrome in just one adrenal. But if you notice that, wow, both adrenal veins have really high levels of aldosterone, then eek, that's bad, right? That's definitely your cause of, that person has bilateral. They have like two adrenal glands messed up causing Kahn syndrome. The reason why you need to know this fact is that it affects treatment. When you have Kahn syndrome in just one adrenal gland, you can take out that adrenal gland. You can perform a unilateral adrenalectomy. But if you have Kahn syndrome in both adrenal glands, then you cannot cut out both because that's high morbidity, high mortality. The thing you're going to do in those circumstances is you're going to give medical therapy. Well, what would this medical therapy be? Well, this medical therapy is going to be an aldosterone receptor antagonist. So something like spironolactone or eplerenone, right? Spironolactone or eplerenone, right? Remember, if you're comparing spironolactone or eplerenone, right? Both of those drugs, the aldosterone antagonists, right? And both of those drugs, they're actually high-value drugs to know for the exam. Because, we use them for a bunch of stuff, right? We know that, spironolactone or these aldosterone antagonists, they improve survival in heart failure, right? It's one of those drugs that improve survival in heart failure, especially after you've tried a beta blocker and an ACE inhibitor, right? Please don't put people on aldosterone antagonists on MBME exams if you've not tried beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, right? Beta blockers, especially drugs like metoprolol, carvedilol, or bisoprolol, right? So you must have given beta blockers and ACE inhibitors, and the person's EF must be down bad, right? Usually like less than like 40 or 30% or whatever, before you start putting those people on aldosterone antagonists. And then don't forget that spironolactone is actually pretty wonderful drug for reducing portal pressures, right? So it's one of these drugs that we can use to reduce portal pressures in people that have cirrhosis, right? Remember, another drug that also has that claim to fame are your beta blockers, especially like propranolol and nidolol. Those are like the two common ones they love to use on exams. You can remember that with the term nurse practitioner, NP, right? Nidolol and propranolol. Right. And then don't forget that spironolactone and eplerenone, right? Yes, they work the same way, but they have some key differences, right? One is going to make your breast grow bigger, right? And that's going to be spironolactone. Because remember, spironolactone, in addition to being an aldosterone receptor antagonist, it's also an androgen receptor antagonist. So it can cause gynecomastia. That's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? Remember, gynecomastia is something that can arise from many, many different reasons, right? Again, spironolactone can cause gynecomastia. Eplerenone does not, right? So what are some other things that could potentially cause gynecomastia on an MBME exam? Well, don't forget, one thing that can cause gynecomastia can be a person that has a prolactinoma, right? So a person has a prolactinoma, so you need a ton of prolactin, right? That can certainly cause gynecomastia. Another way you can see gynecomastia on your exam says they can give it in a teenage boy, right? Every other thing will be fine, but this teenage boy will just notice he has big breasts, right? And usually it's going to be a boy that is obese, right? And they will try to get you to do all these magical therapies, right? But the right answer you're supposed to pick on your exam is to reassure the parents, right? Gynecomastia in teenage boys is completely normal, right? It's completely normal. Or they can give you gynecomastia in a guy that is really tall and has a micro penis, right? Or they tell you that, oh, wow, this boy has like, poor pubic and axillary hair, is really tall, has a family history of breast cancer and stuff in males. If you see stuff like that, I really hope you're thinking about Klinefelter's, right? Thinking about Klinefelter's. Remember, Klinefelter syndrome can absolutely positively cause gynecomastia, right? Gynecomastia is associated with Klinefelter syndrome. Right? It's associated with Klinefelter syndrome. Again, that's actually very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams, right? And then remember, people that are cirrhotics, people that have end-stage liver disease, they can also have gynecomastia on your exam. Well, how does that arise? Well, remember, what's the organ in the body that breaks down estrogen big time? It's going to be your liver, right? So if, for example, your liver doesn't work, right, then you're not going to be able to break down estrogen very well. And if you cannot break down estrogen very well, right? You're going to have hyperestrogenism. And because you have hyperestrogenism, that can cause gynecomastia, right? And then don't forget, if a person, they tell you that, oh, this person has a psychiatric history and they're taking some drug for some psych disorder and they have gynecomastia, well, don't forget your wonderful antipsychotics, right? So remember your antipsychotics like haloperidol, quetiapine, clozapine, aripiprazole, all those things, right? Those dopamine receptor antagonists. Well, remember, if you're blocking dopamine receptors, there's this pathway that gets a lot little touchy-feely, right? Your tuberoinfundibular pathway, right? That tuberoinfundibular pathway is the pathway of hyperprolactinemia, right? Especially with risperidone, of all the antipsychotics, the big, big, big one that loves to cause hyperprolactinemia is risperidone, right? So the thing that happens is when a person is taking an antipsychotic, their prolactin actually goes up because you're blocking dopamine receptors, that hyperprolactinemia can absolutely cause gynecomastia, right? So those are some key things. And then don't forget the drug ketoconazole, right? Ketoconazole can also cause gynecomastia on MBM exams. So since we're right at the 20-minute mark, I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, again, I offer these review courses for Step 2 CK, Step 3, Complex Level 2 and 3. I offer an MBME test-taking strategies course. I offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, 30-year shelf exams. And then I have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. At least if you want the most recent 150, right? Just go on those things. Look for Divine Intervention Podcast. Please subscribe. Any positive feedback you leave is always helpful. And then another thing I will say is if you want everything, though, from episode 1 all the way to this episode, episode 355, then you want to go on the website Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S.com and, you know, sign up with a WordPress account. Whenever I make a new podcast, you get an email notification. And then I also have a new website. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. In fact, it's called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. It has like 41 episodes right now. And basically, I have these short audio podcasts on life lessons that are just relevant for humanity, right? So just something that addresses a specific need that is common in people's lives. So it, you know, contains a lot of very good Bible-based teaching if you're looking for that kind of stuff. And I even have those podcasts on Apple Podcasts. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts. And then the final thing I will say is I have a YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos, right? Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. If you go there and you subscribe, again, that's where I put all my videos. I've been making more videos in recent times. And again, I'm going to be making even more. So thank you for listening to me. I really hope you found this podcast to be helpful. Have a wonderful Friday. God bless you. Thank you. Be well.